Hello, this is Michael Stone, the host of Conversations. We're committed to bringing you leading-edge thinkers in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. On our program, we look for positive solutions to local and global issues that leave you touched, moved, and inspired to action. Our weekly guests include local and global experts and concerned citizens working together to heal the wounds that separate, alienate, and marginalize people. So my guest today is Andrew Cohen. Andrew has been around for a long time, as many of you know, as the publisher of What is Enlightenment magazine. He's a person who's redefining the spiritual ideal of enlightenment for the 21st century. And through this revolutionary philosophy, his award-winning magazine, and his work with thousands of individuals and groups around the world, he's dedicated to creating nothing less than a revolution in consciousness and culture. He's an American spiritual teacher, author, visionary thinker, and widely recognized for his original contributions to the field of evolutionary spirituality. So welcome to Conversations, Andrew Cohen.
Hi, thank you.
It's great to have you here. I thought we might just start out, Andrew, with giving people, I know you have a book either is out or about to come out on the whole subject of evolutionary enlightenment, but can you give us a little operating definition to start?
What I'm trying to do is to put the whole notion of spiritual enlightenment, and in my case it was the Eastern Enlightenment, in the context of our emerging understanding of evolution. So what we're trying to do now is really look at and understand the whole meaning and purpose of spiritual awakening of the spirit and the spiritual experience, and trying to really see it now in a developmental context as one that's really very much about creating the future, rather than one in where we are embracing our spiritual aspirations as a means to afford us some kind of escape or some kind of liberation from the human experience or from embodiment. So, I mean, just to give a kind of an example, if we would look, for example, at Buddhist philosophy, which is where one of the original notions of enlightenment came from, traditionally, in that orientation, if one became a fully enlightened individual, if one became a living Buddha, then it was said that one's development had come to an end, and one would be liberated from having to come back and live a human birth. One would never have to come back to Earth and would be able to live for eternity in nirvana in a heavenly role, in a heavenly abode, a heavenly realm, a state and a domain and a dimension beyond time. So the idea was, if you really look at it, that in the traditional Eastern Enlightenment, most of the time one is trying to win a kind of vertical, a liftoff, kind of escape from being trapped in the body, from being trapped in time, and from being trapped in a process. But the more we learn about, you know, who we really are, and that we're part of a developmental process that began 14 billion years ago, and we begin to really look into the whole evolutionary developmental process and see how extraordinary it is, and see that how hard the universe has worked to make it possible for you and I to have the experience of consciousness and cognition that we do, we begin to see that our own very own human experience, the experience we're having right now, as really being produced by a developmental process, and that we begin to see that our presence here in the process, that our capacity to bear witness to the process and to consciously participate in the process may very well be the very leading edge of the process itself. So then we begin to see that our capacity for embodiment, for consciousness and cognition is really the very leading edge of, it seems, of a process that started 14 billion years ago, and we begin to see that our capacity to consciously participate in this process, to create the process, to create the future, may be the most important thing that's ever happened. And when we begin to see that our experience of being human beings right now, that if we could really begin to appreciate how lucky we are and the creative capacities that we actually have, we'd begin to see that spiritual illumination now, as I really understand it, is more about learning how to get more into the life experience, learning how to embrace it more wholeheartedly, more passionately, with a much greater commitment, rather than trying to in any way escape from it or to be free from it. Because I think being here totally and unconditionally and radically and completely really is the whole point.
I'm really glad to hear you say that aspect of getting into life, because we've had a lot of people on the show lately, leading edge thinkers, who are talking about this emerging story, David Corton, Brian Swim, mm-hmm. Thomas Berry, Drew Dellinger, Joanna Macy, yourself, all are co-creating this new evolutionary story that seems to be emerging. And for me, that story has to be something that relates to life. Right now, we look out and we see people are scared to death of the financial changes that are happening, the environmental changes. We have so many things happening all at once, and it seems as though time is speeding up, or at least what's happening inside of time is speeding up. How does this model of evolutionary enlightenment fit for the issues of today's time in terms of how I live my own life, and what's the impact to me?
Well, I think that the impact of really understanding the kind of perspective that I'm trying to share, that the perspective of evolutionary enlightenment really is about beginning to recognize that there is no creator or mythical God in the sky who is running this particular show and who's guiding it and who's going to make sure that everything's going to work out okay in the end. That the energy and intelligence that initiated the creative process 14 billion years ago is in human consciousness and cognition and human awareness, and the human capacity for self-reflective awareness is beginning to awaken to itself. So that would mean that as the universe awakens to itself through our uniquely human capacity for consciousness and cognition, we begin to recognize and appreciate that we are the creators. We are the only ones who can make this world into the paradise that we all want it to be. And so what this kind of perspective does is it really, it compels us and also inspires us to want to take greater and greater responsibility for being the creators of the process, for being the creators of the world. And as we begin to accept this and as we begin to understand it and appreciate what it means, we begin to feel that this is our obligation, and more than that, that this is the reason that we're here, that we're not really here just to kind of have a life experience, not to just have experiences and to learn things. We're not here really to have selfish lives. We are really here to fundamentally, the reason that we're here, we begin to recognize, is to literally create the process. So a part of creating the process, you know, inevitably, especially if we want to make the world a better place, which will be an endless work, is we realize that that's actually why we're here. So the fact that we have enormous problems to face now, I think is kind of it's inevitable part of being here. I mean, if we would put ourselves in the position of being that energy and intelligence that initiated this entire creative process 14 billion years ago, I think the minute we took that leap from formlessness to form, from nothing to something, I think we were going to be creating all kinds of problems for ourselves, because if we didn't really want to get involved in the creative process, we would have remained in this unmanifest, timeless, formless state. But for some reason, we decided we were inspired to create a material universe. And the minute that leap from formlessness to form and from timelessness to time took place, we were creating all kinds of problems for ourselves. But since we were that energy and intelligence that wanted to create this universe, we were very doubtless about the fact that we wanted to take this on. So what this perspective does is it gives us a sense of a wholehearted willingness to want to embrace responsibility for making this world into the kind of world that we want it all to be, and that, which means we feel a lot less victimized by just finding ourselves in the midst of a process that we don't necessarily want to be part of. But we realize that, well, from a certain point of view, you know, we're the ones who, you know, we are the only ones who really created this ultimately from a spiritual point of view. So we realize that this is ours. This is all our creation. And so what it does is that for the postmodern self, for the very highly individuated self, it compels us to, as I was saying before, to embrace life in a much deeper way, and also to embrace all the problems and the challenges inherent in wanting to make the world a better place.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thich Nhat Hanh said quite a while ago that the next Buddha was not going to be an individual but a community. Mm-hmm. How do you see us moving from this evolving individual consciousness that's been so much a part of the so-called New Age movement and the, you know, much of the movement in the last 100 years, really, with psychotherapy and all of that, to stimulating community and cultural consciousness?
Well, I think that the highly individuated self is really a product of the leap from going from a traditional to a modern to a postmodern stage of development. And I think that the fact that many of us have been brought up in this kind of postmodern era, postmodern stage, and we have a very exaggerated sense of ourselves as individuals is both a blessing on one hand and it's a curse. I mean, it's our capacity for individuality gives us a very unique ability to be able to objectify our experience, to see our experience and see the world, to see what's happening within and outside us, you know, in greater and greater contexts. So our perspectives are bigger and bigger. So our highly developed capacity for individuality, our big egos, in a sense, make it possible for us to see with greater depth and greater clarity. But the problem is that we've gotten very stuck, very identified with our separate selves, and this has caused most of us to suffer from kind of a very unhealthy degree of narcissism or self-infatuation.
Not only our self-suffering, but hasn't it also caused, and at the root of much of the suffering in the world, when we look at peak oil, climate change, resource depletion, the kind of runaway growth in areas that are destroying the planet, that is led by, I think, in many cases, the American individualism. Can you say a little bit about how evolutionary enlightenment might be a healing aspect from this deep sense of individualism you're talking about to a more community or other-oriented consciousness?
Well, I don't necessarily think it's that our industrial growth has really just been a result of American individualism, but I think it's generally been a lack of a kind of a world-centric perspective, because a very simple way to really look at, you know, human developmental stages is we go from, you know, the perspective of a small child or a small baby, which is kind of egocentric. The baby's only aware of their own needs and their own consciousness, to kind of an ethnocentric level development, where we are very identified with members of our tribe. You know, we identify everybody who's connected to our bloodline as family, and everybody who isn't as separate. And then there's a leap from egocentric and ethnocentric to when we see ourselves as maybe part of there's a leap to when we identified with people who shared the same creation story, which is when the great traditions emerge. So then when the great traditions emerge, when we would become a Christian, for example, our sense of self would grow from beyond our particular ethnic group or tribe to now sharing a sense of community or connectedness with all others who shared the same creation story or creation myth with us. And from there was another leap to when the nation states formed and when we would see ourselves as members of a particular nation, to finally, you know, and this is just looking at it very broadly, as finally what's happened very, very recently, you know, especially this postmodern stage, is a kind of a world-centric level of development, a level of awareness, where now most individuals of the postmodern stage see themselves as being citizens of the planet Earth. We see ourselves as being citizens of this entire global system, being a member of the human race before we're members of a particular nation or ethnic group or tribe or anything else. And I think that a lot of the problems that you're describing come from a sense of self that doesn't see itself as being part of a world system, that when we see ourselves in any way in isolation from the entire process, we will tend to make choices and to do things that act in disregard of the inherent or underlying truth that we're all part of one process, and anything that we do is going to have an effect on the whole, which eventually in the end is going to affect us. And I think a lot of these problems that we're speaking about are results of that lack of vision or lack of perspective. The evolutionary enlightenment perspective is actually one step higher. It goes from this world-centric perspective to one that's one step higher, which is a cosmocentric perspective, which is now we don't only see ourselves as human beings who are members of the human race and citizens of the planet Earth, but we see ourselves as products of the evolutionary process. So our sense of history now relates back to deep time. So we see the beginnings of our sense of self, or our sense of identity, going all the way back to the beginning of time. And so we see ourselves as products of 40 billion years of evolutionary time. And we see our own capacity for consciousness and cognition, for compassion, and also for spiritual enlightenment as a result of 14 billion years of development. So our sense of self now literally becomes cosmic or cosmocentric. And therefore, we begin to see everything that's happening, including the current financial crisis and the global warming and all the problems that we're facing as part of a process of cosmic evolution. It just gives us a bigger and bigger perspective in which to be able to see all these things.
Yeah, I like the jump as you're going up that kind of hierarchy that you're talking about, because in a way you could say that each of those is another level of individuation, which is another level of separation, which can cause greater and greater conflict all the way, you know, from religions to nation states to on up to the human being separate from the world above nature. And then when you go to that next step, you're now saying that, oh, at this point we, and that seems to be, you know, a lot of people would say the same thing. Suddenly, it's like we've seen the Earth from outer space. We're a part of this whole thing that's unfolding, this emerging thing. And it puts back into context what, of course, indigenous people have mostly been saying all along, that we are all interrelated and we're all relatives and all part of one emerging system in the universe.
That's very true, and even more importantly from the perspective of consciousness, because when we begin to see from the perspective of consciousness, for every exterior there's an interior, we could say that from an integral perspective, we'd say that, you know, if matter is the exterior, for example, if just to look at our physical form, if matter is the exterior, consciousness is the interior, then we begin to appreciate that our own uniquely human capacity for interiority, for subjectivity, for consciousness, as I was saying before, may be the very leading edge of the entire developmental process, which would mean that our presence here is actually important, because it's through the uniquely human capacity for consciousness and cognition that the energy and intelligence that initiated this entire process, if we want to put it in theological terms, which some people don't mind and some people do, but that we could say that God, or the energy and intelligence that initiated the entire process, through the uniquely human capacity for awareness, gains the capacity to bear witness to his or her creation. So as we see the world, the energy and intelligence that created the world is seeing itself. And without our capacity to see it, our highly evolved capacity to see it, that something very significant that has only recently emerged would be missing. So that means, in the best sense of the word, that we are very important.
Yes. Brian Swim, I was recently with, I know he's a good friend of yours, talks about
I'm a fan of Brian.
He talks about how we've arrived at a place in evolution where the future is in the hands of humanity.
Absolutely.
And I think that's both shocking and a real call to get to work, because if we have the power to create or destroy life, and the evolutionary process has now been handed off to the evolution of consciousness, you know, the big question, of course, that's left then is, how do we get a critical mass to choose to create this golden age and to stop the death machine at a point where we are at a very critical point, which most people are really not allowing in, how critical a point we are in the planetary evolution?
Well, I think that's true, but at the same time, I think the way this election is going points to me towards a great sense of optimism. I do think are realizing that we are, not only in terms of our own country, but globally, are in a developmental crisis. And it seems to me that more people than ever are responding and want to roll up their sleeves and want to find ways for us all to come together, not only to save ourselves, but also to make this world a better place. I'm, you know, 53 years old, and I've never felt more optimistic or more hopeful about what's possible, because I've never felt so many people expressing their awareness of our collective problems, but also an energetic willingness to really come together to be able to respond to them. So in spite of the fact that we are facing enormous problems, I think there's especially over the last year and last 6 months, and now especially in this leading up to the election in a week, I feel that a sense of hope and positivity that I haven't really ever felt in terms of this global situation that we're in.
Yeah, I feel the same hope, and I think a lot of us do, but I do have a concern with that, and that is that we're putting our hope in someone who is being handed probably the biggest mess that any president, not probably, for sure, the biggest mess that anyone has ever been handed. And if we think that Obama or anyone else is going to be able to go in there without every single person stepping up to this, what you're calling evolutionary enlightenment, and engaging in it, I think we're really fooling ourselves, just like thinking that the systems that are crumbling right now are somehow going to magically come back in a few years.
I didn't mean to imply in any way, shape, or form that it was going to be easy. But I only wanted to say is I do feel that, because, you know, when people feel hopeful, all things become possible. When we don't have a sense of hope, there's a sense of despair, and there's a sense that there's no way out, that there's nothing we can do to change things or to turn things around. So I just feel that there is more willingness in more people to want to respond in so many ways to the problems that we're facing. And this does give me a great sense of hope. And the fact that we have enormous problems to face and this is going to be very difficult, I hope I'm not kidding myself, but I mean, I assume that this is going to be terribly difficult. But at least now I feel that there is a way forward and that billions of us want to go on that journey together.
Yes, yes, that's also my hope. You know, Andrew, you have spent your life traveling around and talking to groups as a teacher, as a student, as someone creating dialogues. And to me, that's a really important aspect about bringing forth this thing. What role do you see dialogue and inquiry playing in generating and promulgating this new story that's emerging?
Well, I think that through dialogue and through learning how to listen to each other, and also learning how to think about life and about the future and about, you know, a new moral, ethical... See, what I'm very interested in is helping people to grasp what I define as a new moral, ethical, philosophical, and spiritual context for human life, because I feel that especially with the postmodern revolution, there is no really grand narrative, as Ken Wilber would say, or the grand narrative or the meta-narrative, in terms of the sense of really who we are and why we're here and what the purpose of life is, has really become very obscured. And a lot of very sophisticated, intelligent, well-meaning people feel that they're not really so sure why they're here, and they're not really so sure what the purpose of existence is. And I think this is that to me would determine what a spiritual crisis is. Because I feel that unless a human being knows, you know, clearly and with the enormous confidence who they are and why they're here, it's going to be very difficult to live a human life that expresses a kind of wholehearted commitment to life itself. And so I feel that through dialogue, through discussion, through encouraging people to kind of grapple with some of these fundamental questions, more and more of us can come out of this kind of spiritual and philosophical malaise, you know, and existential confusion, and find a sense of a deep, spiritually inspired, you know, positivity, optimism, and unshakable conviction about the purpose of existence and about the fact that they're actually here and this is happening right now, and that we actually have to be ready now to give everything we've got because because it's already happening.
And then some.
And then some. So and the time really is now to do that, because as long as we're really not prepared to kind of live our lives, you know, wholeheartedly, unselfconsciously, and with deep commitment, we are kind of keeping the reality of the fact that this is it at bay. And this is not, I think, not the way we're going to initiate the kind of change that we've been speaking about. So I think it's through dialogue and through deep contemplation that many people can be encouraged and persuaded and inspired to really start digging very deeply, you know, into themselves and asking the biggest questions, which takes a lot of courage and a lot of concentration and a lot of willingness to really take very big steps within ourselves. But I think without doing that, a big cultural evolution at the leading edge isn't going to happen. And so what I'm living for really is to do my own part in trying to help to encourage this movement forward at the leading edge of culture. So I'm speaking about a moral, ethical, and philosophical, you know, regeneration. In other words, are we living our lives in a clearly defined philosophical context, in a clearly defined spiritual context? Is there an obvious moral imperative related to the fact that we're alive? Or are these just very ambiguous questions that have no meaning for us?
If you just tuned in, we're speaking with Andrew Cohen, American spiritual teacher, author, visionary thinker, and we're speaking about evolutionary enlightenment. So one of the things that you distinguish that I think is powerful, Andrew, is the distinctions of the ego, the authentic self, and the absolute self. Could you speak to that?
Sure. Well, the ego, I think everybody already knows about. The ego would be related to the separate personality, which relates to our personal history. So in my case, it would be, if I'm 53 years old, then it would be Andrew, who was born in upper middle class Jewish, secular Jewish family in New York City in 1955, and all the historical experiences he had in his childhood and all the ways he was conditioned by his culture. So that was the psychological ego. There is in Eastern Enlightenment, there is much talk of what's called the ground of being. And the ground of being, I relate to that the zero point or that no place that the universe emerged from 14 billion years ago. So it said that with the Big Bang, something emerged from nothing. So the nothingness or the emptiness is a no place where there's no time and there's no space and there's no history. So it's a place where nothing ever happened. And this place that from where time and for where the material universe and all of creation emerge from is the deepest part of each and every one of us. It's the deepest part of who you are and the deepest part of who I am. And if we both sit quietly and meditate very deeply, deeply enough so that our awareness of thought begins to disappear, our awareness of time begins to disappear, our awareness of the physical form disappears, our awareness of the world disappears, our awareness of our own memory disappears, when everything disappears and nothing is left, we are still there. So whoever we are at that point when everything else disappears is what this absolute ground actually is. And so that timeless, formless, no place is what's called the ground of being or of being, and that's related to this mysterious no place from which all of creation emerged from. And so it's typically taught in Eastern Enlightenment that if we meditate deeply enough, we awaken to this timeless, formless dimension of ourselves, and through that we win liberation from time, from being trapped, a sense of being trapped in time, a sense of being trapped in form and in the body, to the creative process itself. So that's one dimension. The other dimension is that out of this emptiness, out of this nothing, the entire creative process emerged. And when the Big Bang happened, as I said, something came from nothing. So everything that emerged from nothing, you know, the all of creation, all of evolution, the entire material universe, emerged from that nothingness. So it's all really part of one thing. But this creative impulse or evolutionary impulse that caused the Big Bang to happen, which created the whole process, is what the source of life is. So the life impulse, the urge to become, the desire to exist, the creative impulse and instinct that created the universe and that's driving us to have this creative conversation and interchange right now, came from that nothingness. The source of the creative impulse is that nothingness. And when we awaken, when we as individuals awaken to our desire to exist, that's what the authentic self is. I call it the authentic self is the spiritual impulse, but it's a spiritual impulse experienced specifically as an evolutionary impulse, as a desire to exist, as a desire to evolve, as a desire to become more. So the most creative individuals, creative geniuses, you know, the great artists and musicians and engineers and scientists and great inspired politicians and spiritual teachers and philosophers, the most creative people are driven by the evolutionary impulse, and that evolutionary impulse is driven by the same energy and the same intelligence that initiated the creative process 14 billion years ago and that's driving it right now. And the essence of that impulse is what I call an ecstatic urgency. It's an ecstatic positivity and it's an ecstatic urgency. And the nature of the urgency is it's an ecstasy and it's an urgency at the same time. So what I call the authentic self is awakening to that ecstatic urgency that's the very nature of the desire to exist.
Great.
And I believe that the new enlightenment, or the enlightenment that's really going to bring us into life, will be riding on the wings of what I call awakening to this authentic self, this ecstatic, creative urgency.
You know, you talk about authentic self, and that made me think quite a bit about the whole issue of connecting.
Yeah.
Because there's, you know, it's innately wrapped up with my connection with another, sacred other, or other, however perceived. So, you know, there's so many people out there that are really longing for some kind of connection in some way, some deeper sense of connection. And yet we seem to do everything we can to keep that, so that keeps our authentic self from really, it's like a paradox, you know, we want connection, yet we seem bound to this belief of separation.
Sure.
that keeps us bound in this ego place that you're talking about. Mm. Can you speak to that?
Sure.
Some way to authentically move from that to
sure.
deeply connect with people?
Well, I like to speak about it in evolutionary terms. So we could see that we could see in the universe, you know, there's the force of entropy, which is, you know, everything collapsing in down upon itself. And there's the evolutionary impulse, creative impulse, you know, the bursting forth, the absolute will to exist, the desire to exist. And we can all see that in ourselves. So, for example, we could call the experience of inertia or entropy, you know, when the alarm bell goes off in the morning. It's when we don't want to participate in life. We don't want to get out of bed. We don't want to have to participate. We want to just be able to, you know, eat too much and sleep too much and have too much sex and just lose ourselves in sloth and confusion for no good reason. And it's often experienced as kind of an irrational refusal. It doesn't really make any sense, even though it just happens to be how we feel. And often the ego expresses this kind of irrational refusal to want to participate in life for deeper and higher reasons. Whereas the spiritual impulse, or the evolutionary impulse, the movement towards life, towards love, towards creativity, towards spirituality, when we are awake to it, we feel in touch with a sense of positivity, a lightness of being, you know, a kind of ecstatic conviction and a sense of freedom that is self-liberating, that is so thrilling. And when we are awake to that impulse, we recognize the force of inertia and this irrational refusal for what it is, and we see it as really the essence of what darkness is. So we can see that the separate self, as we've been saying, the ego or the separate self, can tend to be very identified consciously and often very unconsciously with this kind of irrational refusal to want to participate in life in a much deeper way, to want to abandon ourselves into the process. And I think that as we awaken, as we experience higher states of consciousness, when we experience, when we have spiritual episodes, when we see through this irrational refusal, and when we have moments of penetrating clarity, and we're awake to this kind of bubbling, ecstatic energy, and the freedom and the positivity that it is, what we want to do is remember that. We don't want to forget, when that's not so obvious to us, you know, what the truth actually is. We have to learn really to make the effort, I always tell people, to be true to what we know is true, even when it's not necessarily apparent to us. Sometimes we just have to kind of have faith, but not blind faith, faith based upon what we have seen ourselves to be that which is true. And as we do that, the force of inertia gets weaker and weaker, and liberated individuals express a kind of a consistency in the expression of this kind of positive conviction in the way they live their lives, which usually is quite inspirational for many others.
Yeah, how I interpret that as I'm listening to you is that on the side of our ego is this pull of inertia, and yet on the evolutionary
yes.
side, there's heart and meaning wanting to emerge into the world as a force for the heart and meaning being in the world.
Yeah, because this is it. I mean, the world is everything.
Right. Andrew, you have a wonderful path, five fundamental tenets of enlightenment, and we've got just under 15 minutes here. I know it could be a whole course.
Sure.
But I'd like you to talk about those five. We like to leave people in a place of, you know, where they can go and something to hold on to, and this path is a wonderful tool, I think, for guidance for people.
Sure.
Can you speak to that?
Sure, I could. Well, these five fundamental tenets or principles are really... they do help us to kind of live a spiritual life, and gives us a kind of a fundamental or absolute orientation to the human experience that keeps things really on the straight and narrow, so to speak. So the first of these principles is what I call clarity of intention, and I'm stunned to see that there's so few of us that have really asked ourselves a very obvious philosophical, spiritual, moral question, which is what's more important to me than anything else? Because I think if our lives are going to be lives of meaning and purpose, we have to first define, you know, very clearly and very accurately what is more important to us than anything else. So in the teaching of evolutionary enlightenment, the answer that we're, of course, hoping for would have been, probably if someone had met me kind of 10 years ago, it would have been enlightenment. But now, as I've moved on, it would be the evolution of consciousness. The most important thing would be the evolution of consciousness. And if we realize that from an evolutionary perspective that the evolution of that consciousness is not something that exists out here, but is literally the very essence or ground of who I am, consciousness is really who I really am, then if the evolution of consciousness is more important to me than anything else, I realize that the evolution of my own consciousness, my own emotional, psychological, moral, ethical, and philosophical, and spiritual development, is what's more important than anything else. It's going to help me to define, you know, really what my relationship to life is and how I'm going to live it. And also, more importantly, what we begin to see when we have spiritual experiences is that I am the whole. I'm not separate from the whole. We begin to see that as my capacity for consciousness and cognition evolves, then I begin to have a very positive and uplifting effect upon the world around me, upon all the individuals that I interact with and meet, and just upon the world itself, that my mere presence in the world then would have a kind of uplifting quality. So the first of the five principles is clarity of intention. What's more important to me than anything else? And if we have to want to liberate ourselves from fear and doubt and confusion, from the fears and desires of the ego, more than anything else, if we're going to be able to evolve in a very powerful and concrete and dramatic and meaningful way. So being very clear about that intention, being very sure about it, being very absolute about it, I know that the evolution of consciousness is more important to me than anything else, and I'm willing to put that first, is the foundation of the spiritual life as I teach it. So the second of these principles is what we call the law of volitionality, and it means that if I want the evolution of consciousness to be more important than anything else, I have to be willing to take unconditional responsibility for myself. That means who I am and everything that has happened to me, you know, in the past, and the consequences of everything that had happened to me in the past are now my responsibility. So I have to take responsibility for the entirety of who I am, for the best parts of myself, and also all the parts of ourselves that aren't maybe so wholesome. You know?
And you're not talking about blame. You're talking about being responsible for what comes out of those experiences.
Well, I'm talking about actually stopping to blame anybody for our own predicament. That, in other words, you know, it's a big thing to get to that point in our own spiritual development where we're willing to take unconditional responsibility for the totality of our karmic predicament in the present moment. It doesn't mean that, you know, we haven't been subject to trauma or abuse, you know, at the hands of other individuals, but the consequences of those events are now our own responsibility. So we have to be willing to take responsibility for the consequences of everything that's happened to us. We are our own problems, and we blame no one else for our own predicament. So when we accept unconditionally the responsibility for our own predicament, you know, in all ways, there's a sense of empowerment. We literally empower ourselves to take responsibility for our own destiny. And it's so, so liberating. We really, you know, when an individual does it, they break karmic chains that may, I do believe, often never get broken for many, many lifetimes. But when we say, no, I'm willing to take unconditional responsibility for my own predicament right now, we free ourselves from the chains of the past, and we become our own master in that sense. We become a master of our own destiny. The third principle says, if we're interested in the evolution of consciousness, if we want to be free more than anything else, we have to be willing to face everything and avoid nothing, which is, I think, the kind of ultimate form of spiritual practice, is really facing everything and avoiding nothing. Many of us are, as we all know, quite unconscious of many of our motives. In other words, the left hand often doesn't know what the right hand is doing. So if we want to be free and liberated human beings who are really taking responsibility for the evolution of consciousness and culture, if we want to become masters of our own destiny, we have to learn the art of paying very close attention to what our motivations are, to what we're doing, to why we're doing it. We have to be paying attention to everything that's happening inside us and everything that's happening outside us all the time. We want to learn how to pay very close attention to what's happening so we can take responsibility for what we're doing. In other words, someone who is really facing everything and avoiding nothing, which is, of course, a heroic spiritual practice, that's a heroic spiritual act, is someone that rarely acts out of unconscious motives. That means that most of the time that is an individual that they know who they are and they know what they're doing and they know why they're doing it. And this is really, it's quite a big deal to face everything and avoid nothing, because to face everything and avoid nothing means we have to face the worst parts of ourselves, the darkest parts of ourselves that most of us want to deny exist. And at the same time, we also have to face into the fact that we all have capacities for greatness, for higher development that often we're unwilling to admit, unwilling to accept, unwilling to face how great we could possibly be. Most of us choose the path of mediocrity because it's a lot easier and less challenging. So facing everything and avoiding nothing is really a big deal. And the fourth one is the law of impersonality, and it really tells us that the perspective of enlightenment is really seeing the all of life, and including every aspect of the human experience, as part of a process. That, in other words, there's no part of this cosmic process that we're all part of that is separate from the other. You know, as they say in Mahayana Buddhism, for example, you know, everything that exists is dependent upon everything else. So it's all part of one process, and nothing in the process is separate from any other part. And so when we begin to see our own human experience and every aspect of our own human experience, including every aspect of our personal experience, from a perspective of it all being part of a process that is not personal or an impersonal process, it gives us a great deal of perspective to see everything that we're experiencing, including the worst of the ego's pangs of fear and doubt and confusion, to sexual desire, to joy, even to spiritual ecstasy and the experience of freedom and clarity. We see this is all part of an impersonal unfolding, and it gives us enormous perspective on everything that's happening, because the more we see everything that's happening to us and within us and around us as part of a process, we see it less and less through the lens of the personal ego. And there's an experience of what I call transparency. Everything becomes transparent to itself, and we see the one process that's occurring more than the individual events that's happening within it. And this helps us to not lose this higher or enlightened or spiritual perspective. It really helps us to really stay true to our own deepest spiritual realizations. I can't say how significant or important this is, especially when it gets to the real, very nitty-gritty realities of human life. And the last one, which is really the most important in a certain way, has to do with the reason that we're living. And so the last one says, for the sake of the whole, or for the sake of the evolution of consciousness.
So welcome to Conversations, Andrew Cohen.
Hi, thank you.
It's great to have you here.
Conversations is an
independently produced program supported by KVMR 89.5 in Nevada City. I thought we might just start out, Andrew, with giving people, I know you have a book either is out or about to come out on the whole subject.
We're committed to bringing you leading edge thinking in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. If you would like to receive our complimentary newsletter, The Well of Light, make a contribution, or order any of our past shows, please call 530-477-7757 or go to our website at rwelistening.net.